The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Menards 11% rebate is here. From lighting to lumber, from doors to floors, the bigger the project, the bigger the rebate. From painting projects to that new kitchen makeover and designing that outdoor space of your dreams, save big on any project you're tackling. Hurry into Menards for an 11% rebate on everything. Mail-in rebate is a merchandise credit check, not a point-of-sale discount. Redeemable on future in-store purchases only. Not on future purchases on Menards.com. See store for details.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello there, I'm Chris Difford and welcome to the podcast I never thought it would happen, made in collaboration with the wonderful charity Help Musicians. My guest this week is a guitarist who used to live next door to me back in the old days in Deptford. His band supported my band Squeeze, and he went on to do amazing things, like play Wembley Stadium, while Squeeze were playing at the Oxford Arms in Deptford. He's a fantastic guitarist, sold millions of records, and he's still going and having a lovely time doing it, as we all are. So please welcome my fabulous guest, Mr. Mark Knopfler. I can see you loud and clear.
Isn't that an amazing technology?
It is, except I'm holding a lead because I've got a stereo into a mono plug. And it reminded me of being in sort of the early 70s when you had headphones with curly leads.
Well, anyway, you were always plugged in, Chris. So I hope you don't go up in a blue light, you know.
Well, welcome to this humble podcast for the charity Help Musicians. It's lovely to see you.
Nice to see you too, Chris. And it was a fun, really fun playing on the Deptford song. Have you still got it, or is it coming out, or are you going to do something with it?
Oh, yeah, I want to thank you so much for playing on that track.
My
it's
pleasure.
Coming out as a podcast. It's part of a musical podcast about the estates that I used to live on. And in fact, you used to live in Deptford. What are your memories of that time?
Well, you know, they're very good memories, actually. I think everybody on the estate... the neighbours were fantastic about the band playing, you know, that because we covered a room with carpet underlay,
yeah,
you know, one of the spare bedrooms,
yeah,
and it made no difference to anything. So I think everybody just put up with it, and the neighbours never... I mean, all the people that lived on the estate were really either students or teachers.
Yes.
But I don't think they let normal people live on the estate. They didn't... back then, they considered them to be below the level of what was required for housing. But they're still standing, those flats. They were built like tanks.
They were, weren't they? Yeah.
Yeah.
They were indeed. And you used to play in the local pubs there. Did you play in the Oxford Arms?
We never played in the Oxford. I don't really recall bands in the Oxford particularly. We used to drink there.
Yes.
Because it was only a few yards up the road. And... the estate, our building was on the ground floor, you know, but furthest away from all of that. So it was down towards Creek Road, you know, it was more the, what was the name of the, was it the Duke? What was the name
the
of the other pub?
The Duke.
Yeah, the other end. That's where I had a guitar stolen. One of the roadies put it in the back seat of a Volkswagen. What can you imagine?
In Deptford?
Yeah, in Deptford. And then he parked it outside the Duke. And then in that was the making movies guitar. That disappeared entirely from the world.
No.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah, wow. You used to rehearse next to us in the Woodwharf. Do you remember that?
Very well. And yeah. I loved it. I loved the Woodwharf.
Yeah.
Because you could look out on the river. You know,
yeah.
There was something, so you could kind of skive off, you know, and in between songs you could sort of dream.
Yeah.
And I've always loved being able to do that. You know, I've always suffered from lack of focus, and so that Woodwharf suited me perfectly for all that. And it's just a great place to dream.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Mark. I remember, you know, endless rehearsals in there, and just you could look out the window and just drift off for ages. It was amazing.
Yeah, exactly that. And I still remember those barges, you know, roped together just under the window there, and just, I can remember it all really, really well. And as I got to know London even better, you know, with the years going by, I'm still not sure where. There's a bit where the river just goes like the Nile, you know, and it goes all over the shop. And so down by, well, I guess Silvertown and round by the Dome, all of that, you know, was built. Sometimes you're never sure what side of the river you're on. Do you ever find that? I know you're actually from that manor, you know, so you should probably know exactly where you are at any time. But I still get confused when I'm down that way, wondering, certainly if I'm on two wheels, I get a little confused what side of the river I'm on sometimes.
Yeah, no, I don't get confused because when I was growing up, you really didn't want to go across to East London. It seemed like going back into Dickens' time.
Yeah, it was. It
you
was.
Know, a place called the Isle of Dogs, for instance. I mean, you're just too scared to go over there in case you got bricked in the face. But I think it was all myth, really. You know, and look at it now. You can't afford to live there, of course.
I can't believe that somebody told me that Deptford had been gentrified, and I just laughed. I couldn't believe it. And somebody else told me that even Peckham has become gentrified.
Even Peckham.
I do remember Walthamstow, you know, when I was working up that direction, and that was certainly hadn't been gentrified, but now I understand even Walthamstow's been gentrified. I used to go to Walthamstow Market on a Saturday.
Yeah, I know, it's incredible. Peckham, it's all become too expensive to live in. How did you get to Deptford? Where had you travelled from? Where were you living?
I was living up in, just up on the London-Essex border, because I got a job there, which saved my life, actually. Mm-hmm. It was a teaching job. And I tried to be a rock and roll musician and paid the price for that. And I was in recovery from that, in a way.
Yeah.
Just trying to get some money for wheels and some rent and all the rest of it. So it was the usual thing. It was a thing that I shared with a lot of musicians that I knew at that time. And actually, talking of your charity, Chris, you know, your very commendable work for that charity, it was as relevant now as it was then. And we could talk about that a little bit, perhaps, because it
Please
was
go
all,
ahead, yeah.
Well, it was already, it was part of the language, you know. Dire Straits, actually, the name itself was coined by a lad who was living in a house with Lindisfarne in North London, mm-hmm. with Pick Withers, our drummer, and some other musicians, Cy Cow from Lindisfarne and a bunch of others. And this was a keyboard player whose name I never really knew, but he was living in that house. Mm-hmm. A pianist, and he said, "Why don't you call yourselves Dire Straits? Because that's what you are, you know." So we were.
And perfect.
It was perfect. It was a perfect name. We used to try and seduce Pick to coming down to Deptford to rehearse with promises of fish and chips and some Virginia tobacco.
Lovely, yeah.
So that's how we managed to keep hold of Pick, because Pick knew what he was doing.
Did he?
He'd spent some time in Rockfield Studios, and he'd spent time doing a little bit of recording and was technically proficient, you know. And so he was terrific. And I could see that he knew what we were supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
Because the rest of us were pretty green. So it was worth making that trip to make sure that Pick kept coming down to Deptford to work with us, to rehearse with us, and to record the demo with us as well, which we subsequently sent off to Charlie Gillett and Radio London, and the rest is history.
Charlie Gillett, what a wonderful man he was.
He really was. Yeah. He was a lovely, lovely man, and he wanted to sign us for his own label.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, Oval Records. And we almost did, but there were offers coming in, and we actually took one of the last offers. You know, I don't know whether you're familiar with the pattern with these things,
yeah.
But when you're hoping to get signed,
yeah.
There's a little bit of a rush on, and then there isn't.
Yeah.
Because nobody wants to be part of the retreat from it, you know. Yeah.
It's an amazing journey that you had there, because, you know, if I remember you guys rehearsing next door, and then I blinked and you were at Wembley, it seemed to me. Mm-hmm. That must have been an extraordinarily quick journey. Was it? Did it seem like that?
Yeah. It was a little bit traumatic in terms of that.
Mm.
But I'd sort of spent quite a long time playing and, you know, learning stuff.
Yeah.
So I'd kind of, and I also I'd been progressing on a sort of double front, because I'd ended up in folk places because I couldn't afford the gear to play in a rock band and have amps and a car to carry it all in and all of that. So I ended up borrowing friends' acoustic guitars, and a folk singer in the Northeast showed me how to do the sort of four to the bar fingerstyle, which was the saving of me, really, because after that I'd got a job in Leeds and was living there for a few years, and I got to know a blues singer called Steve Phillips there, and Steve had a proper record collection, and it really pulled me together in terms of of having that side to my playing, you know, as well as the electric stuff. So wanting to be in a rock band, yes, all the time, forever, but forever, but wanting to being in love with the blues and all of that stuff. And Steve had this kind of collection that nobody else had at that time, so because he was another maniac for it all, and so that was very useful to me. That very more than I would probably realize at the time, but it was a huge thing for me knowing Steve.
And when you say proper record collection, what kind of records did he have that you didn't have?
I didn't have any. I mean, I never managed to hold on, because life was pretty unsettled for me for a number of years. So I never managed to. I mean, even when I went back to Deptford, and if I had any records, they were gone.
Mm.
Everything was changed. Everything was in turmoil. And I remember even my sister Ruth had made me a patchwork quilt, which I loved, and that was gone.
No.
Yeah. So it was just, I never could hold on to. But I did have a few records because of the Evening Post in Leeds, where I used to help out with a music column sometimes, although the job was really belonged to somebody else. But I used to get hold of the odd record that would come into the office. So I did have, you know, one or two records at one point, but I never managed to put together. I was never a Mr. Vinyl.
Right.
You know, I didn't really know. Every now and again you meet people who are real vinyl heads, and they know even the numbers of records.
I know.
You know, that is a fantastic thing. And there's a couple of guys that I've played with over the years, for a lot of years, that have huge record collections. Richard Bennett and Jim Cox, you know, they have enormous record collections. And I think that's a wonderful thing because they're both kind of walking encyclopedias.
Yeah. Where do you find the time to play records these days? It's...
I play records now in front of my laptop on Spotify, listening to young artists or whoever it is, just drifting around. And I've got some good speakers which go unused quite a lot of the time because I'm just, you know, I'm just listening casually. But I think back, you know, a lot to the times when I just had little plastic cassettes.
Yeah.
I never objected, did you? I mean, you know, we had them in cars and we played them all the time.
Yeah. In fact, I've just bought a cassette player just recently and it's very modern. It's got one of those plugs that goes into your laptop if you want to record from it.
Oh, there you go.
It's an amazing thing. But, I mean, you know, people who have massive vinyl collections and then you can go on Spotify and listen to things. How do you think the industry has ended up? Because it's completely different from when you and I began.
I don't really know where to kick off there, Chris.
Yeah.
You know, I do remember times when the Beatles were getting a penny a record.
Okay.
And I loved the Beatles.
Yeah.
And I loved the Stones and I loved all the beat groups, you know.
Yeah.
And they were getting ripped off then by the business. And it seems to me that the business has found an ingenious way to carry on doing the same thing.
Yes, it does.
Don't ask me how it works. And it's far from me to. I've done incredibly, incredibly well. So I'm not bitching about that from a personal point of view, but I do know a lot of musicians, great musicians, who deserve a better deal from the game. I mean, I still don't understand how. I know that my manager, who has been an agent and a manager and a promoter and a roadie and everything's come up the whole way, and as he understands it, I think he understands how it works, how the game works, but I don't. I have to admit that I'm mystified. I believe Spotify, you probably know more about it with working for the Musicians Charity, but as far as I can make out, it seems as though the record companies own a big chunk of Spotify if they don't own it already. And so they're already making sure that, you know, their end of it is
sewn up.
Is sewn up, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was at the Ivor Novellas the other week and an artist called Ray got up to get an award. And she's an incredible person. She tore the record companies to shreds when she was getting her speech, saying it's not fair for the younger artists.
No.
She got a standing ovation. And, you know, you've got the old generation, you know, the old way of doing things and the new way of doing things. And I don't think it really mixes together very well yet.
No, I mean, but I never really know what to say to a young songwriter now, because it seems as though the rules are off, you know, everything's off, anything can happen. So what I often do is I offer my manager's advice, you know, and say, look, you know, I'm not the man to ask about this, and I like music, I don't like the music business, and I don't really understand it, but the one thing I do understand is that when we started, I think it was going to be 18 months before we got any royalties. That was how they structured it when we started. And the only way that we could get anything in was to change the accounting periods. So to shorten them, the only thing you could offer them was more what they called product.
Yeah.
So more records was basically how it happened.
And
then you get your lawyer to negotiate the royalty up to a working level where it's respectable or halfway respectable, and you go on increasing that, you know, as you sit down to negotiate with them.
Yeah, those were the days.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app, with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, America. It's your new favourite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two-fourths of the British podcast No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.
My name's Joe Baker. I'm a music producer and DJ based in Bristol. I release music as Creed, spelled with a K, and I'm also really proud to be one of the thousands of artists supported by Help Musicians. I was always into music growing up, and my dad's a musician, so always sort of had that interest, you know, music that my dad showed me, records that my dad showed me, and also from like TV and film and all that stuff. It was a real melting pot. Definitely a lot of rock or sort of guitar-based music for sure, like Radiohead, things like that was huge. Two of the records I remember being really important for me that he showed me were, I think it was the first Arctic Monkeys album and the first Streets records. They were both really influential for me. So obviously like Arctic Monkeys on the kind of, on a songwriting tip, I think the Streets blew my mind as soon as I heard that. Those were two really important ones for me. But I'd say the main sort of moment or spark where it all kicked off was the first time that I managed to get on GarageBand software when I was a kid. And it was one of those moments of sort of just the kind of the realization that you could record sounds in. There's all these like stock loops and stuff, and you could just move things around and build tracks. It was kind of game over from that point, really. You know, there's no going back. I was like, I just want to spend all my time doing this now. And yeah, technology's been sort of at the heart of all of it for me. I started off playing guitar, but as soon as I found all the music tech stuff, that was where it all kind of really started. So, but I feel really lucky to have been able to experiment at that time. 2000s really, it was sort of at that golden moment really, where it was all properly switching to being really accessible to everyone. So obviously, you know, like online communities like SoundCloud, I basically just sort of grew up on SoundCloud really and met so many amazing friends and collaborators on there. So yeah, I feel really lucky to have sort of grown up at a time where with all that new exciting software coming out and, you know, lots of creative things happening in that world. A few years on, when I moved to Bristol, it was like another huge spark, more in the sort of DJing world and the live music world, sound system music world, you know. So I think those were the two kind of main key points for me. I really wanted to do like my own sort of big project. I'd done, you know, released music when I was younger and was releasing music during that time, but I loved albums and really wanted to make my own record and kind of knew, had an idea in my head of stylistically, it was very influenced by Bristol music, had this sort of moody undertone and all the sound system elements. You know, releasing music is one thing, and it's obviously, there's loads of ways now you can do that. They're accessible, but the album side of things is where it gets tricky for sure if you want to do it properly, you know. And I think it was a friend of mine who put me onto the Help Musicians process and the support they offer. Yeah, it was just like a bit of a no-brainer to give it a shot, and even just the application process itself kind of sort of helped me inform myself on what I was doing, you know, just sort of writing it down and trying to lay it all out really helped me pinpoint a few key things I wanted to work on or ideas that I had. And yeah, when the support did come through from Hub Musicians, it was like a game changer for the album, and sort of having that support there really allowed me to kind of give it the time and effort that I wanted to give it as an album project. Also had that layer of like someone else has got a bit of confidence in, you know, in the work or what you're doing, and that was really nice to have. So yeah, that's definitely been a huge highlight for me. Yeah, learned so much from it, and the Hub Musicians support really was like a key factor in all of it coming together. The support they offered was obviously the financial element, which was amazing and really, really helpful. I wasn't really aware that there was going to be any other elements to it. I kind of was absolutely buzzing to have a bit of help financially. But the support that came in on top of that with business advice was like really, really, really helpful. I remember thinking, I don't really know what this is going to be, but all of them were like just really well thought out, focused, yeah, sessions on different aspects of the release. So there was one that I did that was more based on the digital marketing side, which was something I was really lacking in knowledge or even like passion for, really. And that really helped me spark some ideas for ways that I could work on those aspects in a way that was like enjoyable for me and within budget, and just was, yeah, super, super helpful. And then the other one I did was more of a sort of creative coaching type course or sessions, where it was more open-ended, I guess, and about creativity and about ways that you approach the work and ways that you approach collaboration. Also super, super helpful, and like really helped to instill some more confidence in me to keep pushing with the project, but also just it ended up just sort of applying to everything I did after that. So yeah, the sessions were amazing and a huge help for me. I think for me, one of the main things I've struggled with is just how crazy the hours can be. You know, you're just sort of like an independent musician, or I guess anyone that's self-employed, there isn't really any time off. I mean, the positive side is that it's almost completely stuff that you really love and are really passionate about. But for me, it's just, yeah, I don't know the last time I had a proper day off. You know what I mean? So yeah, support is obviously really important, and a support network generally is really important. So like touching base with friends, I'm lucky that loads of my mates are in a similar position or work doing similar things, so I sort of try as best I can not to cut myself off from anything, which is kind of easy to do if a lot of what I do is like studio work or DJing as well. And both of those sometimes can be a bit quite easy to cut yourself off from other people. So yeah, the support network's really important for me, just friends, family, like touching base with people. And I haven't had any like further support from Hub Musicians since finishing the project, but I know there's been loads on offer, and loads of my friends have recommended and been raving to me about support that's on offer. And I've been looking at it recently again, just like options for advice sessions they do, and almost like therapy sessions. Even knowing that that's there is like a huge help, you know, to sort of know that there is someone who's gonna sort of have your back and specifically understand the creative music, self-employed aspects of it, you know. So yeah, it's definitely something that I've got on my mind and want to explore more. And it's amazing that it's there, because people certainly need it.
Help Musicians is a charity for working musicians across the UK. To find out more about the support they offer, why they do what they do, and how to support them in creating a world where musicians can thrive, visit helpmusicians.org.uk or find them on social media today.
When you were a teenager, who was the first band that you went to see that you stood in the audience and thought, actually, this is
for me,
something I'd really like to be part of?
Chuck Berry.
No way.
Yeah, Newcastle City Hall. I was 15.
Wow.
And he duck walked across the stage, you know, and my God. And, you know, a lot of the damage was done then. But, you know, the great thing about those songs was the lyrics and the music. It was the lyrics actually reverberating like the music.
Yeah.
So that's really good writing. And
yeah, it had a rhythm, didn't it?
The writing had a rhythm, yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, you could trace it to, you know, today's rap or Lily Allen. Or,
absolutely.
You know.
Of course you could.
It's the same rhythm. It's the same rhythm.
Absolutely. And so it's a language thing, and it's different from poetry, and it's different from ordinary prose, you know. So it always kind of amuses me, or often amuses me, when poets think that they can write songs. And maybe they can sometimes, you know, I don't know. But it's its own thing.
Yes, it is, yeah. And do you remember walking out of... I loved the Newcastle City Hall. It's a great place to play. Do you remember walking out of there and thinking, OK, I'm going to be in a band?
Yeah, absolutely. It was just the absolute cliche, you know, the kid in love with, you know, and the despairing looks from the teachers and, you know, all those
parents.
Things. Parents. All those things, you know. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was just I was gone. And it was the top of the slippery slope.
So did you go straight to a guitar shop the next day and sort of look through the window?
You know, I was already looking at the guitars, yeah, I was already. But yeah. There was a certain amount of wariness on the part of my folks just because they could see rock and roll wasn't, they didn't think it was going to end well, and maybe it hasn't.
Mm.
You know, I think there was a feeling that, A, it wasn't particularly respectable, you know?
No, I remember my parents, when I started playing in the band, they said, this is going to end in tears.
There you are.
You're going to end up an addict. You're going to end up skint. I said, well, great. I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, but what can you do? I mean, the thing is, a kid's got to do what the kid has to. You have to do what you have to do. And I don't think there's any way you should stand in the way of that. I think as far as possible, you've got to encourage it, and I'm amazed by, I'm just like I was amazed by the neighbours in Deptford. I mean, the people in Newcastle were our neighbours there were fantastic, because my dad had built a little garden shed like he did everywhere we lived, and my brother David had a drum kit in that shed, and we used to hammer the hell out of that thing, and you could hear it all over the gardens, you know, all over the neighbourhood. I mean, and nobody complained once. That was just amazing to me, that just people were so nice about it,
yeah,
and so patient about it, you know. And what about when I was trying to play boogie woogie piano, bad boogie woogie piano from a very early age on our pianos, and my parents used to drive them crazy, but they didn't stop it.
No.
They never stopped it. They just let it all happen. And so I'm kind of indebted to that. You know,
of course.
The fact that there was no stuff, right, that's it, that piano's blocked, you're not playing that rubbish on the, you know, because all I wanted to do was Boogie Woogie and Bee Bumble and the Stingers and, you know, Nut Rocker and stuff. Just, I was like a little mini Jules, except the Jules can play. I couldn't play. But you can't stop that. I think it's counterproductive to trying to make kids go the way you want them to go. It's not going to work out like that.
Absolutely right, yeah. So you've gone from a garden shed to British Grove, which is one of the most renowned studios in London now. Do you have days when you just are on your own there and you're just creating?
No, I don't use the studio to write.
Okay.
I think it's a waste. I'd like people to be in here recording.
Yeah.
Because that's really what it's for. Because I could always just stay home and try and write a song.
Yeah.
So I don't tend to come in. To say I'm coming in to write sounds self-important. You know, I'm coming in to write.
Everybody out of the way.
that's just not my style.
I can imagine.
So I think I would if I was doing any writing, I used to write on the road after a fashion on tour. Yeah, so just go a bit short on sleep or something, and or if there was a day off, for instance, or I could, you know, just find a chair with no arms that I could play guitar on.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, in a hotel, I'd just be hunting around for a chair that I could use to play guitar on, and then try and catch up with the songwriting there. So I would have a...
Yeah.
I used to... for years, I just tore up a lot of paper until the word processor came along, and then...
Yeah. What's your relationship with touring now? Do you ever look forward to it? Or is it something doesn't fuss you anymore?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it all. I loved the whole thing. I loved rehearsing. Good. I loved touring.
That's great.
You know, and I loved the gigging. But then I just found it harder. And so I think if anything was going to quit, it would be the touring now. And I'd just be concentrating a little bit more on writing, I think. Also, just having the studio has been so great because I can come in and work on a record. So I never could do that before. Whereas having a bunch of songs that all I need really is Guy Fletcher, you know, because he's a trained recording engineer. So he can run the studio and play a little bit of keyboards, and then we can make skeletons of songs, which you'll be familiar with.
Yeah.
And we could just make those little skeletons and, you know, run up songs, explore the form of the song, decide whether it needs another thing in it, another little bridge or something, or something else. And so that's been fun to do with Guy in the studio. But the big deal is when we can get the band together. When you've got the whole band and
creating magic. Yeah.
Well, maybe, hopefully. But that's a wonderful feeling. It's all good. I mean, the way Guy and I do it, it's just like with our toy box. This is my toy box, my favorite toy box, Meccano set. But with a band, it's wonderful because, again, some of them are Americans, so it's difficult to get everybody together. So it's a mixture. The band's a bit of a mixture. But it's a lovely feeling, and you'll be very conscious of all of that. You know? But so you'll know both sides of it. So where the lonely person on a sofa somewhere and the person in the middle of a band creating.
Yeah, I find you can also be lonely in a band. I mean, our band has been together, parts of it anyway, for 50 years. And so the sort of relationship is completely different from when you first meet. You know, when you first meet and get in a rehearsal room like Woodwharf or whatever, there's absolutely no baggage there. There's just the ambition to be in a band.
Yeah.
And then the other end of the tunnel, it's kind of a little bit more complicated, but it's still the most rewarding thing, being on stage and playing those songs that were written all those years ago.
Well, yeah, you realise that you've been creating signposts for people's lives.
And,
people have used the songs to live with.
Yeah, it's a wonderful journey, of course. And when you think about, you know, some of the earlier days when you were just sort of heading out as Dire Straits, you must have a memory or two of Top of the Pops.
Yeah, I suppose all of it. I do have memories of all of it. I mean, just going off to a date, you know, off to a studio to meet the band somewhere and using VIP cars in Deptford and the car breaking down and me helping the driver push the car.
No.
And, you know, just all of those memories that just the whole thing is still very much alive with me, you know, all of it.
And do you write about it on your records?
I think sometimes, yeah. I don't think you ever leave your childhood behind.
No.
It's just a different way. It's like you say, your view changes and your perspective changes with age and time, but it's all good. It's all valuable to keep it all alive because that's what life is. It's being able to use the perspective of time. So you're kind of looking at down the telescope, but from the other end sometimes. And, you know, because you know that the road in front of you is shorter than the one behind, you know.
Good Lord, yeah. That's a very good comment. Certainly is. You don't know how many more tours there are.
Oh, I don't think be any for me, really. I don't know that there will be any because it just got, you know, physically it gets harder to do. I think a lot of people handle that side of things better than others. But I've been very lucky in the sense that it was a proper chunk of work. You know, what I mean is we did hundreds of gigs. And a pal of mine who works for American Record Company was telling me that he worked in artist relations. He was showing a singer of a young band that they just signed their first tour. And he said, here's your first tour. Showed him a piece of paper. He said, you've got 29 shows. And the guy goes, 29 shows? He said, I didn't get into this to work. I think we'd done about 300 shows at that stage in the tour when he was telling me that story. So it's not altogether wasted, that time.
No.
Do you think it counts for something, all that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I think touring down the years, and we've done hundreds and hundreds of tours now, has created a space for us to travel back and respect our catalogue in a way that only we could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a fantastic band, so I'm very happy that that is the case. But as I get older, I'm 70 this year, and I look at a date sheet with like 40 dates on it, and I think, how am I going to get to the end of this without...
That's more of a challenge with age, isn't it? Yeah.
It is, and I don't sleep on a bus, so I'm not very good at that. So the you know, you have to throw yourself into it and just go for it. And, but it's still enjoyable when you get up there and look at the audience enjoying your songs. Like you say, you've left these flags for people to sort of follow through their lives. So we're very lucky. But well-being on the road is something that is new and respected, I think, now. Everybody that I speak to in the industry is like really careful about how they look after themselves, whereas in the past nobody really cared.
No,
you know, it was like, okay, gig over, let's go to the pub.
Well, yeah, or even sometimes before. I mean, I remember we were playing in Ireland, and we were walking across to the gig, and it was pitch black. We walked across like a playing field or something, and I saw the lights of a pub, and so let's have a pint before we, you know, go to the gig. And so we went into this pub, and I walked up to the bar and I said, can I have 6 pints please of what's best, the Murphy's or the Guinness? And he said, they're both exactly the same, he said, only the Guinness is better. But just lots of memories, you know. I just treasure it all. I think it's a blessed life in a lot of ways. If you can give people that amount of pleasure, and also, I do have another story in the sense that I was walking down a corridor with somebody after a show somewhere in a college somewhere, and this bloke was coming down the other way, and he stopped me. He stopped us and he said, "I just wanted to know," he said, "I had to be dragged out tonight." He said, "I was feeling really, really low." And he said, I can't tell you how low I was and what I was thinking about doing. He said, "But I want you to know that I'm going on." That's all he said.
Wow.
I want to go on. And so, you know, that you think, oh, well, maybe I'm not just completely useless. Maybe there's a point to it, you know.
Yeah. Oh, there is a point to it, that's for sure. Yeah. There is a point to it. Well, Mark, thank you so much for giving up your time today. And
pleasure. It's a pleasure, Chris, really is.
And, you know, I heard the record that you did with all those guitar players for charity, which I want to commend you on. I think that's an amazing record with Jeff Beck and yourself and God knows everybody, basically.
God, yeah, Jeff. Dear, oh dear.
Yeah, and you did an incredible job there for that charity, and I think that's a wonderful thing, so thank you for that.
All right, Chris. Been a pleasure to do.
Thank you. Speak to you soon. Well, thank you, Mark. That was a wonderful conversation, and we delved quite deeply into what it was like living in Deptford in those days, which is important for us both to remember where our roots were and what happened, I suppose. And, you know, I think what's so great about talking to Mark is his ambition to be who he is, a fantastic guitar player, still resonates today. Only proof just recently when he did this fantastic charity record that I recommend you listen to, along with great guitar players like Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, Tony Iommi, so many names. Anyway, what a marvellous interview. I really enjoyed talking to Mark. And thank you for listening. If you want to know more about the amazing work of Help Musicians, do them please take a little time to look at their website. Follow them on social media like I do. And please consider donating a little money to the charity. As you hear in every episode, they do incredible work supporting musicians of all types across the UK. They really do change people's lives for the better. Keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.
Hello, America. It's your new favourite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two forts of the British podcast No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.